wealthy debt, war, corruption, treason, and an open season on human rights. Tears at the fabric of our nation, and the tragic realization is that future generations will pay the big price. Wake up and shake it up, America. From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea, our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow. So we better sow carefully. This land is your land.
This land is my land.
If we come together and work together, we can pull the weeds that threaten to destroy our land. I hope and pray you understand, we cannot reap a good harvest with a bunch of bad seeds. Wake up and shake it up, America. From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea, our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow. So we better sow carefully.
Abraham Lincoln proclaimed, "We are a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, not of the corporations, by the corporations, and for the corporations." He also observed, "You can fool all of the people some of the time, and some of the people all of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time."
Wake up, shake it up, America.
Our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore them. So we better sow carefully. Wake up and shake it up, America. North to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea, our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow. So we better sow carefully. Wake up and shake it up, America.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Taking Back America, the official show of Take Back America for the People. We're a 501c3 whose mission is to educate the American people and people around the world about the costs of allowing corporate control of their government. Those of you who caught last week's show know that I'm doing a two-parter here, talking about some of the problems that are going on in Canada that are very much related to what's going on in the United States. I've been talking about them with my guests Al Lau and Lisa Carrillo, and they are the hosts of Transition Mission program on Awake Radio. And they see their mission as getting people around the world to understand that these are common problems and we have to work together to solve them. So I thought they'd be perfect guests for this show. Because when taking back America is not going to be something that Americans can do all alone. It's got to be part of a worldwide democratic revolution, nonviolent, not talking about violence, obviously. And it sounds to me like Al and Lisa have the exact same idea. Al and Lisa, thanks for being on the show again. Welcome back.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Rick. It's a pleasure, as always.
Oh, you bet. Same here. Now, the last show that we did was sort of outlining some of the major problems facing Canadians and relating them to some of the changes that have occurred since your Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, took power. there's been a dramatic shift in policies that seem to be very parallel to what's going on in the United States. I'm talking about things that affect income inequality, poverty levels, the environment, personal freedoms, civil liberties, the support of the countries, U.S. and Canada, for war. These are all things that seem to be moving in the same direction. And we talked a little bit about why that is. The biggest reason, of course, is that governments are becoming increasingly irrelevant, and we are really moving toward a one-world government, not in the paranoid sense that the UN is going to control the world, but in the sense that the multinational corporations, which are largely owned by banks and Wall Street financial corporations, they're taking over. They're determining policy. They're determining policy at places like Davos, like the G7 conferences, like the Bilderberg conferences, and behind closed doors at Bohemian Grove. You know, this is where these people get together. We're not talking about they make plans and vote on them and then say, okay, this is what we're going to do with the world. But they talk about these ideas and they develop a groupthink and then they all move in unison. And that's why we're seeing so many parallels between what's going on in countries like Canada and the U.S., countries like U.K. and France. It's because they're all listening to the same voices, the most powerful voices of all, and that's the voices of the banksters in the international banking cartel. this is, again, a fact-based show. I am not going to make assertions that I can't back up, but I will say that if you want to understand where that comes from, I'm not going to repeat the whole argument. I've said it many times on the show. You can go to our archives at SFPI Radio and listen to all the old shows. In particular, you might want to listen to the show I did with Ellen Brown, who is the head of the Public Banking Institute, another issue that's very important in Canada is public banking. Anyway, she and I talked about this at length for about an hour, how that works. So, without further ado, that's a long introduction, I want to give Al and Lisa a chance to talk about the good things that are happening. We talked about the problems the first show. This show, we're going to talk about what people are doing about it in Canada. Lisa, you're the one that told me about the Comer case, the Committee for Monetary and Economic Reform, an organization that brought suit in a Canadian, I think it's the Supreme Court. One of the chief petitioners was Rocco Galati, who I gather is quite a firebrand up there.
Yes, he's our constitutional lawyer. He would make a great PM, too, also. I think if there's a little party that would like to have him voted in, but this man is actually, for how crooked we think a lot about how the court systems are, I think in Canada we perhaps have a little bit more leeway than you do in the States.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that a little bit. I think this case will sort of highlight some of that. Tell us a little bit about that case, Comer case. What's it about?
Okay, as we kind of touched on in our last broadcast, 1974, our world really changed here in Canada. Before that, we had the Bank of Canada, which was actually, it was nationalized in 1938, and it was wholly owned by the Canadian people. So it was the Canadian people who were basically controlling the monetary system. And this went on between 1938 and 1974. And at that time, the government borrowed money from us, the Canadian people, to build all our infrastructure, our highways, our hospitals, our medical system, everything in our social nets, everything that made actually Canada a really good country to live in. But that all changed when during the Trudeau government in 1974, and instead we ended up selling out basically to the banksters, I guess, to put it in blunt language. We became globalized and became the now on a national scale, and they made it sound so good, and like all of a sudden, here's Canada, we're part of the rest of the world and whatever. But meanwhile, what we didn't know is that what we were actually doing was paying compound interest to banksters and losing all our control over our financial situation.
So what you're saying is that prior to 1974, when it was a public bank, the bank itself, the country, the national government, could create money, and they were the only ones that could create money, and then just put it into the economy, so they control the monetary supply. Now that's a function that you're saying has been taken over by private banksters since 1974, just like it has been in the U.S. since 1913. Is that right?
Exactly.
Okay.
So instead of us printing money, money's just a fiction. It's just a matter of a trade tool, right?
Right.
Instead of us making our own method of doing trade, we give it over to globalist banksters, who private banking institutions, who then charge us compound interest. So since 1974, if you want to start taking a look at the amount of debt that has increased, the amount of how our infrastructure has crumbled, I mean, you can just trace it all. It's very, very easy. There's graphs out there that you can see in that.
Right.
People are becoming, actually, it was a teacher that brought it to kind of surface. Bill Abrams, his name is. That's where I first learned about it. And he really explains this in very easy terms, and you can see exactly what went on. So in 2011, there was a committee for monetary and economic reform, Comer, therefore the case that Rocco Galati has taken on, along with two other private citizens that have been involved in this, and they're suing the Canadian government. And basically they're alleging that the Bank of Canada is the only central bank among the G8 countries that is a public bank, created by statute and accountable to the legislative and executive branches of government. Here in Canada, we have a really, really good solution to our economic woes right now. The main problem is, first of all, there's not enough media on it. Hardly anybody knows. I've been trying to tell people about this for, I don't know, the last 5-6 years at least. So there's such a media, but it's starting to come out, which is very, it's very promising, right?
Can I ask a couple of questions about what you've said so far?
Certainly.
You're making the case that the bank was created to serve the public interest, basically. It's owned by the national government originally. What they did then was they turned over this power to create money to private banks in 1974. I'm wondering, how the heck did they sell that? How in the world could they make that sound like a good thing?
We didn't hear hide nor hair of it. Well, at that time, in 1974, my mind wasn't on, you know, and that's the other thing, too. We were turned away from politics. It was really a media manipulation. Because if I remember that era, I remember them making Trudeau look like some big rock star.
I do too.
Remember that? Like he was, just the best thing. And I still hear people saying that here, especially the older generation. I mean, like he was one of the best prime ministers we ever had. Meanwhile, he was, as soon as that happened too, he started putting in, the whole thing with the PR. We won't get into it, but it started becoming fascist actually.
Well, you know, I remember in the American press anyway, they made him look sort of like I was reminded of Kennedy and JFK and Jacqueline Kennedy. That was sort of the image that seemed like the press presented of him, glamorous, this wonderful couple who were doing had all these wonderful ideas about how to help the world. I didn't see anything close to it until Clinton. Who he wasn't exactly glamorized, but on the other hand, the press wasn't particularly critical of some of these globalist things he was doing. So the United States long ago gave away their power to create money to private banks in 1913, like I said, when they created the Federal Reserve. They took the next step, which was creating these free trade agreements. And joining the WTO, which was something even George H.W. Bush couldn't get past. Well, maybe it was because he was a Republican. So you put in a guy, you present him as a liberal, and he can sell this. And he did. And he's being richly rewarded right now, making hundreds of thousands of dollars for each speech he gives. like anybody with any common sense wants to know what he thinks.
Well, here in Canada, we have Trudeau's son, who is running for, he's neck and neck with the Conservative, Liberals, Conservatives, and NDPs, Green Party. Those are the only really options. The Green Party, forget, they'll.
Oh, my God.
It's like they're pushing, you get the same families. He's part of the family.
Well, you know, they're just making it pretty obvious. It always has been about families. It's just they weren't so obvious, you know, running sequential members of the family. The Roosevelts did it. They were supposedly from different branches of the family, and maybe they were to some extent, had different political philosophies. They were different parties. But now you've got, you know, three Bushes, sons of a senator. Two of them have become president, another one aspiring to be president. You got two Clintons, husband and wife. Wow.
Yes, you'll probably have another Jeb Clinton showdown.
Yeah, we probably will, unfortunately. We don't have much in alternative parties either. That's another parallel. People think that Canada is this has this advantage over us being a parliamentary system, that somehow you can get coalitions going like they do in some of the European countries. That doesn't really happen in Canada, does it? Isn't it basically a two-party system with some fringe parties that are represented?
Exactly.
No, well, in Canada, we have somebody called a governor general. And if he doesn't like where the politicians are going, the governor general is a representative of the Queen of England. She has the power to shut the parliament down. And it has happened.
Really?
We're still under British rule.
Tell me about that. I thought you guys got your independence back in the, 70s?
No, we've never gained our independence. Canada's always been under British rule, and the Queen is this is one of our biggest stumbling blocks. I would say.
If you go into any court, high court or low court, whatever, her picture is above you. If you go into any university or anything like that, her picture is there.
Her picture is on all our money.
Well, I did know that.
There you go.
There's a little symbol.
I don't know where I got the idea you guys had officially become independent. You must have done something that made you
There was a fight through with the French and the British for a while, but the British took over, and it's really, we've been under colonialist rule
Canada. You still have today parts of Canada considered crown land.
Wow, that is so shocking to me. I mean, I have for decades thought you guys were independent.
Immigrants coming over have to pledge their allegiance, not to Canada, to the Queen.
RCMP. Oh my God.
RCMP pledge their allegiance to the Queen.
Not to the country.
The Queen can prorogue any government. So if anybody thinks that this family that's not British or has no power, they really need to look into all the British, I mean Australia.
They have control of the laws.
Yeah, you mentioned Australia. That's something I also recently learned about. You said that in Canada they have disbanded the parliament. They actually got rid of a prime minister in Australia back in the 70s who was standing up for Australia against the Anglo-American Empire. I can't remember exactly what he was doing. I think one of the things he did was he said the missile base and spying base at Pine Gap, if they were going to keep it, they had to make some agreement, that it wouldn't be abused in other ways. I can't remember the details. You guys know what I'm talking about? John Pilger wrote about it.
I've heard a bit about it, but to be honest with you.
I actually did some work with a work on some of John Pilger's work, but I did it more on some of the sweatshops.
Okay.
Asia and stuff. I didn't get into that aspect of it.
Well, for people that haven't heard of John Pilger, he's a Australian journalist, sort of
brilliant
sort of investigative journalist. The thing that shocked me was I asked around with my Australian friends, and some of them knew about this, and other ones didn't even know about it. What happened was, just like you said, Al, the Governor General of Australia stepped in and stripped him of his office.
That's the real power.
Wow, no kidding.
Yes.
I mean, it's like having a kill switch on the internet.
Exactly. Yeah.
What are you going to do? Can't do it through the political system.
The speeches too. There's a speech between the, I forget who the Prime Minister of Australia was in Harper at the time. I can picture his face. But it's word for word. You can go on the internet and search it. Word for word. And it was about going into the Middle East to fight the war about.
You could put Harper's talking, and you could put the Prime Minister of that time of Australia, and they were like reciting the same speech.
Well, you know, people talk about how American politicians use talking points, and they usually are referring to the Republican Party. I think it's true of Democrats too. It's the same around the world, and in fact, I did a show with Scott Ricard one time from the NSA, who knows quite a bit about this, and he explained how the CIA has tremendous influence over what we are told about foreign affairs and foreign policy, and that's one of the ways they keep us confused. They just lie, they omit stuff, they twist things, so they're giving you a totally different view of something that skews what it means. And they just leave stuff out like what happened in Canada. Nobody ever mentions that. Like I said, I meant to say Australia. Even Australians don't remember a lot of them. So, but listen, we're kind of getting sidetracked on some of the negatives, and we did want to focus on the positives here. So let's go back to the Comer case, Rocco Galati's case, asserting that the Public Bank of Canada, or excuse me, the National Bank of Canada, was established as a public bank, and there's a constitutional argument that it has to function that way, even though the Parliament gave away that power to create money and control the monetary supply. They gave away that power to private banks in 1974 with the Banking Act, apparently when nobody was paying attention. It wasn't in the corporate media. So they did this thing, and what he's arguing is that was unconstitutional. Now, Lisa or Al, do you understand the arguments there, why he's saying that's unconstitutional?
Well, basically, this I don't understand all the arguments, but there's also another person that we need to mention is Paul Hillier. He was our Minister of Defense for a while, and he's quite involved also in this, in spreading the word about this case. He basically says, I mean, the whole thing was done illegally. If you go through all the court system that we're going to go through with Rocco Galati, it's taking a long time, but it's bringing awareness. And what I find about this court case that is so interesting is that if we're not aware of what's going on, then we can allow people like the Queen of England or whoever the entity is. I mean, we're not going to blame it on the poor Queen of England, I'm sure. She doesn't have much to do with it, right? But it's just a matter of, but the whole thing was unconstitutional to begin with. But with the way our current court, and since we're going through a British court system, and there's nobody, but you need to find a judge that's going to be brave enough to go against this entity that they're fighting right now.
Go against the crown.
So you're saying, okay, so you're saying, let me just make sure I got this right. Not only was it unconstitutional to do this, but did you also say that the way they did it was illegal, the procedure they used?
Yeah, well, the whole, we already had it, was already set. It was a law. It was set here. How can all of a sudden have one prime minister that can come in through the back door and change the whole way our banking system works when it was already part of our constitution?
Okay, so you're saying that I thought the Banking Act was what changed everything. You're saying it was actually an act of the Prime Minister?
Well, I don't want to get into detail. I'm not, to be honest with you, I don't want to get into the legalities of it. I'm just going by what I've been researching.
I got you. I just get curious about these details. I'm kind of interested in legal things. The thing that struck me, I read an article just today, actually, did a little research for this, about this case. And the thing that struck me was apparently the arguments are that according to the Canadian Constitution, there's a right to life, liberty, and security. And one of the arguments is that this giving away the money supply and the power to print money to private banks threatens security. It also threatens economic opportunity, which is apparently guaranteed in the Canadian Constitution. And it also claims economic rights for the people, which is, I gather, implicit, not explicit in the Constitution. That's pretty amazing. Is this guy crazy or what? Economic rights is a function of the government ensuring economic rights. Does that make sense to you?
No.
Sounds socialist to me. Isn't Canada a socialist country?
Is Canada a socialist country? Well, it depends what you call a socialist, right?
Okay.
On the surface, it seems so, but it's not.
So maybe it is if you define it a certain way. So let's define terms. How would you characterize Canadian system?
Totally capitalist right now. It's kind of capitalist. We do not have any of our rights have been slashed as much as your constconstitution has been slashed. Canadians' rights has been slashed as well. And they're all, it's the same people that are working for the same agenda to make sure that, that they stay in control. But I'm very positive because I see all this information coming out.
Okay. I think it's very important to make that point, Lisa. You know, what is socialist? Well, I don't know. It seems like most people people that are against it anyway, seem to define it as the government having a responsibility to help take care of the people and ensure equal opportunity. That was actually one of the bases for this case, to ensure equal opportunity to succeed in the capitalist system. They call that socialist. That's crazy, I guess. But you're saying that no, Canadians traditionally, or at least since Prime Minister... Not Prime Minister, he was the provincial Prime Minister, Tommy Douglas, really made this case. He was never the national Prime Minister, was he?
Tommy Douglas? No.
Yeah. Okay, well, he was a provisional Prime Minister who was behind Canadian system of health care. And
yes.
He was voted the number one most popular Canadian of all time just a few years ago, and
yes.
And consistently in other polls for years. The point is that, yes, it is a capitalist system, but that does not mean that the government doesn't have a role to regulate capitalism, to make sure that people have a fair chance and that people's basic needs are met. And that was Douglas's argument through his whole career. And he fought side by side with union workers who were getting beaten to establish those rights. He was a real brave guy. He was a man of the cloth. Who did this from religious and moral principles. And he was a hero in Canada. Does that mean he was a socialist? I mean, come on. What does that mean? Was Jesus a socialist? Let's have a discussion about what that means.
Exactly. Isn't the government the people? Shouldn't the government be the people helping the people? Since when? Where's this third entity that all of a sudden the corporation comes into?
Well, I got to say that it seems like when you read about what freedom means to most Americans these days, they think it means economic freedom. And to them, that means corporations have the right to do whatever they want, to make profits, and we all benefit from that. It's crazy, but this is a widely accepted assumption. And the more and more people accept it, the worse and worse things get, but they don't make the connection. This is the cause of income inequality. We talked on the last show about how it worked. Things worked. In the United States and Canada, they worked for decades when we had systems where people's basic needs were met. Anybody that wanted to work could get a job, or in Canada, they even had guaranteed unemployment insurance. Nobody starved. Well, I shouldn't say that. There's always been poverty, but they tried to address it. And in general, the population as a whole, on average, was getting better every generation, and now things are getting worse. And people are not asking themselves why. But they are. And this Comer case, coming back to that again, is one of the ways they're doing it. Because one of the core reasons is that the banksters control the money supply. They make money out of nothing. They put it in the government treasury and say, okay, now you owe us that, with compound interest. And that's the crazy part. When that happened, we lost control of our own government. That means that the politicians capitulated to the private banksters, and they're still controlled by them. We see this when we look at who Obama makes his economic advisors, the very people who trashed the American and world economy. Is it the same in Canada? Or are you seeing the same kind of people who were involved with that dictating economic policy up there?
Oh, definitely. It's down towards the court, you know, who pays for the all the advertising that goes along with the with their cases to you know, when you have an election. It may not be as bad as it is in the United States, as obvious maybe, but I think there's a lot more back.
It's not that it's bad. I don't think it's that obvious.
Yeah.
It hasn't been shown, but it is exactly mirroring your country.
Well, that's important for people to realize. You know, the way I look at it, one of the essential problems in the United States is that we have a privately financed system of elections. And when you think about it like that, it's pretty obvious that that's a problem. If people get to pay for elections, obviously they're going to get benefits. It's the fact that it's privately financed. It should
be publicly.
Yeah, well,
unions are one of the biggest financers. And not just I believe in unions, but when unions start financing your next prime minister, your next party, don't you think that union has their own corporate interest at mind?
Well, it depends on the union, first off, and it also depends on whether the leaders of that union are held accountable by their members. It depends on a lot of things. Not all unions are good, and not all unions are bad. Not all corporations are good, and not all corporations are bad. But the unions that have historically had the most power did some pretty bad things. And the corporations that have and still have the most power, they've done even worse things. The problem with the unions, well, there's a couple problems, and I want to do a whole show on this. Number one is they were infiltrated by criminals back in I don't know when it started, but certainly in the 70s it was revealed that some of the biggest unions in the country were run by criminals who were in league with crooked politicians, et cetera, et cetera. They were not necessarily serving the interests of their workers, even with the dirty deals they made. As long as the leadership got rich, that was fine. And they would one union would be used against another. The Teamsters, for instance, was brought out to suppress the United Farm Workers strike and intimidate the farm workers back when Cesar Chavez was trying to organize them. So the problems are complex. And the problem is when a union gets too much power, and it's not bad that a union has power because it's a counterbalance between corporate power and worker power. But if the leaders of that are not accountable, then they tend to become corrupt, just like corporate leaders who are not accountable to the public and politicians who are not accountable to the public. So as far as I see, the real problem is not the individuals involved. It's the system. It's the lack of accountability. It's the ease with which these people are corrupted. People that want power for its own sake are the ones that seek these offices, and they're the ones that will take advantage of them. It doesn't mean that everybody's corruptible. It just means that not enough people who aren't corruptible are willing to get in the fight.
It's interesting you mentioned the Teamsters, because up here in Canada, we have the Teamsters up here also, and they are involved in the truck driving, the logistics, the bread, milk. They supply a lot of the food to the airlines, to the airports, to a lot of the restaurants. I mean, they are huge up here.
Yeah, they were in the United States in the past, and they still are as far as unions go, although I think AFL-CIO is bigger here in the U.S. But yeah, I mean, how are they using that power? Are they using it to fight for everybody? I don't think they are, not effectively.
Yeah, here in Canada, we're seeing a lot of unions that are using it for good, too. We're seeing marches against Bill C-51. The unions are one of the biggest people that are going against what's going on in the government also.
Well, that's great. I am not seeing any of that in the United States for issues like that. I do want to point out again, not all unions are bad. You brought up the issue of them having too much power sometimes, at least sometimes in history. But workers need to have power, and I don't know any other way than unions to do it right now.
Like a big cabal, like your oil and gas, our energy sectors. And they're not even from here, you know, like if we take a look at what's going on, like how many provinces have privatized our energy, our electricity, and that.
Mm-hmm.
And these are all, they're globalists. They're not even from here. And
well, our people who supply our electricity on the side of the truck, it says our city, Halifax, but right under it says Emera.
Yeah. Check out into who Emera is and who owns Emera and who sits on the boards. And these, they sit on the boards of all different other big multinational. It's like they change chairs on a Titanic ship.
Yep.
And they put these puppets in.
Well, you know,
connected.
You know, since we're focusing, try and focus. I know it's hard to stay on the positive when there's so much crap going on. But you brought up the issue of fossil fuel extraction and dependence of the country on fossil fuels, and especially Alberta. That's a really interesting situation right there. I see the collapse of the fossil fuel industry in Alberta as a good thing. It's making tar sands extraction uneconomical, and that is one of the things that needs to happen, I think, in order for us to save the planet. But it's causing a whole lot of pain there. However, despite the fact that it's causing pain, I think it's necessary, because in the end, once that stuff was extracted, there would be no jobs. There would be no incomes for these people. They wouldn't be paying taxes. And since these corporations don't pay taxes, as you said on the last show, not to speak of.
Well, in Alberta, it's like basically the only province that doesn't pay taxes. They were that rich.
Like Alaska in the United States, where they actually pay Alaskans a couple thousand dollars a year. But, yeah, I mean, so that's the basis of the whole country's prosperity, is that there's a lot of rich people in Alberta, and they, to some extent, the wealth spreads out because they spend it, especially average workers spend it. But that's going to collapse eventually. And
well, I think that's the fall of also the Harper government. Harper goes with it, and that's a good thing. And the NDP are now in Alberta.
Yeah, I know, and I'm gonna work our way to that after I talk a little bit more about this collapse of the fossil fuel industry. I mean, it isn't gone, but lots of jobs are gone. The tax base is terribly undermined. People are losing their houses in Alberta, and it's all because the Saudis are pumping oil like crazy to try to undermine the economies of Russia and Iran, their enemies.
But they're also taking us down at the same time.
They are. And, you know, some people even speculate that they're doing it in part to punish us because we're not supporting them in making war in Iran. I don't know.
That's another show.
That's another show. But the point is, that seems to be the basic cause, even though the corporate media tries to confuse us and say it's some marketing strategy. This is crazy. You know what their explanation was for that? They said, oh, they're overproducing right now because they want to capture the market. Well, there's only so much oil. It's going to last for so long. Why do they want to capture the market by selling everything really cheap? When they can't produce it that cheaply, somebody else will do it. It's like, it didn't make any sense. It's not a sensible marketing strategy. You know, let's make less money now. No, they were obviously doing it to hurt the countries that are even more dependent on oil. But with, like you said, without getting into the details of that, that's the cause. The effect is that fossil fuel industries in Canada are hurting badly. Is this going to hurt Harper in the next election? He said there's an election coming up.
Oh, definitely.
He's wavering big time in the polls. He's wavering.
Wow. And
like we talked about, that was his platform. His platform was creating jobs, and the tar sands was his baby. And once the tar sands goes, he goes as well.
You know what they call it? The con government. The con government.
Okay. But anyway, this is the promise that politicians make. Oh, we'll all get elect me and we'll all get rich. And that's all people care about. If the economy's doing well, they keep voting for the same. You call them fascists. I call them corporatists. I think it's the same thing. So we keep voting them in until everything falls apart. Well, it's guaranteed to fall apart. But guess what? Harper's going to be rich whether he stays in or not. He's done his duty to the corporatocracy, his buddies. But in the reason, again, that I say this is so good is I think it may be our only hope for beginning to address global climate change. Now, Naomi Klein has been fighting the good fight from there in Canada for quite some time. I'm sure you guys are familiar with her work.
Yes.
Oh, I am, yeah. She's a staple here in Canada. I think most of us, actually, awake or not.
Well, I think her her most recent book, This Changes Everything, made one point that I can't repeat often enough. She said that the reason that some people oppose doing anything about climate change is that doing so would interfere with a free market. And that's their religion. They have this magical belief that the free market solves all problems, even though experience over the last several decades makes it obvious that that's not true, if you want to pretend we actually have a free market anywhere. but that's a point that I think we have to. And then, of course, there was the Pope coming out and talking about the importance of dealing with global climate change. You guys read about that, I'm sure.
Yes. Showing up at the UN to talk about climate change.
Yeah, and he's being attacked by supporters of the fossil fuel industries here in the United States and politicians who are supported by them. It's amazing, but, you know, it gives promise. It's one of the positive things that's going on. And you also mentioned the NDP, the National or the New Democratic Party, took power in Alberta after this economic collapse. That seems like a positive thing. Tell us about that.
Well, the gentleman who is in running is Mauclair.
But first, they won a provincial election.
That's what I meant. Yeah, let's start with the provincial election in Alberta.
In Alberta, yeah.
Yeah, so, oh my, and I should check the name. I'm sorry, I forgot the person's.
I can't remember her name either, but it's not critical.
Okay.
What's the significance of her victory?
Because this was the first time, actually, that Alberta has not voted for either
a Liberal
or a Conservative. And it was because of what's going on. So people wake up when the cookie jar, when all of a sudden they see, you know, that those, you know, the job there is really not there for them, and people start waking up to all the other things. It was never a good thing. I mean, even though there's some people that are making some money out there, it's polluting the planet. Instead of global warming, I call it, it's pollution. How much more pollution can this world take for this oil and gas sector?
Right. I mean, there's lots of reasons to oppose fossil fuel dependence. Global climate change is only one of them. I'm so glad you brought that up.
Yeah, because there's a lot of people that are not, I don't believe that.
Well, we've had friends of ours, Native friends of ours, who have done healing marches around the tar sands, and they've taken pictures. And you got to see what the sky looks on top of the tar sands. It looks like False Doom or some, you know, like in the movie with the three of the ring.
Uh-huh.
It looks like something evil is happening in the sky.
Have you ever seen the satellite pictures of the tar sands?
No, I haven't, but I saw Lord of the Rings.
Yes. Okay, well, that's what the sky is.
And if you want to see a real picture, just get a satellite picture of how destructive this, and the tailing ponds, what it's doing to the water. I mean, there's no sense in what we're doing here. We're ruining this country for profits for these same people that we're not really getting a few jobs. That's the only thing that's held over everybody's head. And in a way, too, it's like people do not understand that they don't need these jobs. Imagine if we brought back the Bank of Canada and started instead investing in real green energy and getting off of fossil fuels on a nice, controlled manner, where not everybody's going to have to, like this thought, too, of all of us going off grid and, you know, like that's not going to work either. We've got to be looking.
I have had many friends who have come back from working in the tar sands because, as you know, in Nova Scotia, there is no jobs. And one of the biggest working forces out here in Nova Scotia actually migrate to Calgary and to Alberta. And one thing about Nova Scotia that I don't know if people know about, that we have the largest long-distance builds And I was wondering why that was. And the reason why that is because our young people don't have work in their own towns and their own cities and their own province, that they have to migrate out of province. And that's the reason why we had the long, one of the highest long distance bills and one of the largest long distance bills in all of Canada. And some of the stories I heard about them is how many days and weeks it is to get that tar sand oil off your skin.
They hate it. It's horrible. It's like working in the slave trade.
They work 12 hours a day, and it's like working basically in a slave pit.
And, of course, there's real health risks for the workers when they're being exposed to those petrochemicals.
Yeah, a lot of them come back sick.
We know about that, and yet all we talk about is the jobs. As if we don't have any choice in what kind of jobs that we're going to create in our own countries. We leave it up to the free market. The free market is a bunch of corporations that are increasingly becoming concentrated in the hands of a small international banking cartel.
Yeah.
Talked about this over and over and over. Not going to give the stats again.
The 44% rise in cancer rates.
Yep.
And guess who profits off that? Is, once again, your other entity that we have not mentioned is your pharmaceuticals.
Oh, yeah. Yep. And of course, the private corporate healthcare industry here in the States, less so in Canada, but it's even true there, as you explained in our last show, because that's a privately owned system, even though the government handles the financing. And I want to draw another parallel too here. You talk about health risk to the environment and to workers and whatnot. All true. Here in the United States, there's something that's even worse. They actually put uranium tailings, the parts of uranium mines that aren't concentrated enough to be worth extracting the uranium from. They put these tailings in gigantic piles, mostly located on Indian reservations here in the United States.
We have a group of people too who are involved with Committee for Future Generations, if anybody up here in Canada.
Well, we have a show on that on our website.
It's the uranium industry also is another as bad as the oil and gas industry.
Right, and yet some so-called liberals are saying, oh, people need to get over their paranoia of nuclear power. Hey, it's not clean. It's dangerous. It kills lots of people already, and we need to admit that. There's good alternatives that we can work towards, and we can do it much faster than most people think.
Exactly, because there's so many out there. That's the other thing. We're talking about solutions. Do you know how many we've heard of and just doing simple research? So what we don't know about, where there's viable solutions out there for energy, for free energy, even if it's not free, for at least clean energy to begin with.
Right.
But in a nutshell, all because we were slaves to a banking system that directs all our energy resources, every single one of them.
Well, they have so much money invested in this product that we call oil.
Mm-hmm.
They have all their marbles in this one product. And that's why how much of our daily products that we use actually come from oil. You wouldn't believe.
Well, that's
the ash bulbs, the sneakers that we're wearing.
Our perfume, I heard the other day, I met a Mi'kmaq woman. It was wonderful on the bus. And there's a lot of people that are waking up. I'm going, how come people are so allergic to perfume all of a sudden? And she tells me, because they started putting petroleum in it.
Oh, jeez. Well, you know, all of this sort of highlights what Klein points out. The only solution is to violate the free market religious principles and impose restraints on these corporations that have trillions of dollars of potential profits sitting in the ground. If we let them extract all that, I happen to believe global climate change is real, and it's going to be catastrophic. But even if it's just a coincidence that the glaciers are melting and we're having all these crazy weather patterns and whatnot, even if that isn't explained by global climate change, the pollution will be horrible. And as you say, it's a centralized system of generation of power. So political power literally equates to economic power, and it all traces back to sources of power, electrical power, energy power, whatever you want to put it. We can break free of this, but it's going to mean challenging those corporations, which means we have to challenge our politicians. We have to tell them we won't tolerate their corruption anymore. We have to change the way they're elected, get rid of privately financed elections. All of this, these are key elements of what people need to be focusing on. Even if you don't, again, even if you don't believe in global climate change, if you don't think that fossil fuels are going to literally destroy human civilization, it's a lot of people do. So it's something we can work together on because there's lots of good reasons to stop it anyway. And one,
I don't believe it's going to ruin civilization. I don't know if it will be from a weather upset or whatever. But I mean, you just go into a, just travel and go into a city with a lot of car exhaust. You can't breathe.
Oh, yeah, well, go.
There's black soot coming out of it. Like, this is healthy. Look at China. Like,
well, let me suggest that you go to...
Well, any big city with a population of over a million or under over 500,000.
Yeah, well, there's another cost that we haven't talked about yet, and that's why don't we try going to, say, Tikrit or Mosul or to Homs or Damascus, where entire neighborhoods and cities are being leveled, where millions of people are being displaced and they're starving, kicked out of their own countries, and not to mention the millions that are dying from the wars that are really basically about fossil fuels.
Exactly.
As far as I'm concerned, that's reason enough right there to get off them.
No, well, you're absolutely right. I'm glad you mentioned that because what we found out recently from a friend who actually traveled there, an American.
No, Rick is
your friend. Oh, my God, your friend.
John Mesler.
Yeah, he's been on this show, too.
Yeah, John Mesler said it is to level Syria so they could build a pipeline through Syria to compete with the Russians to Europe.
That is basically true. Iran wanted to actually had an agreement in 2011 of all years. They signed an agreement to build a pipeline that would travel through Syria and Iraq on its way to the Mediterranean. Guess what happened? ISIS all of a sudden appeared.
Oh, yes.
Because al-Nusra wasn't vicious enough to defeat the Syrian army.
And that's what Harper up here in Canada now, we're fighting. Against ISIS.
Wow, Rick, we've come full circle.
Get us. I mean, like, people need to wake up and just start. It doesn't take letting go of that fear of losing your job.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think if people want to visualize the kind of society we need, they should probably start taking a look at what the Canadian tribes call First Nations.
Yes.
They had societies that worked, and they were in harmony with nature, and people were happy. We've been taught they were savages, that they were uncivilized, that they, you know, didn't take advantage of their resources. Now we're seeing the consequences of the lifestyle that Europeans have chosen, and that we're trying to impose on the rest of the world. It's unsustainable. The Native American tribes, I'm not aware of any of them that were capitalist. And they worked very fine. And guess what? People, Tom Hartman wrote in his book, The Last Days of Ancient Sunshine, where he talks about the need to end fossil fuel dependence. He talked about the fact that the Shoshone only worked 2 hours a day on average. 2 hours a day. And they were happy. They had children. They had time to play with them. They had time to indulge in arts, in making love, whatever it is that people do that makes them feel human, rather than having to engage in dehumanizing work 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, just to feed their families. That's the choice they've given us, unless we give ourselves another choice. But to do that, we need to seize control of our own governments.
Exactly.
Beautifully said, Rick. Beautifully.
Yeah, it's like there's a land in the sand right now. That's what I see. Either we can go to this beautiful world where we just realize, look, we've been taken advantage of by some evil, you know, like some powerful control who knows no limits, and right now they're unstoppable unless we as a group of people get together and go, this is absolutely ludicrous. What are we doing this for?
Yeah, you know, I mentioned that for a couple of reasons about Native Americans. First of all, I wanted to honor the fact that you guys talk about that a lot on your show, about Native American lifestyle and converting to a society that's something more like that. But also because the First Nations in Canada stood up and created a movement called Idle No More to fight the exploitation of their lands. You want to talk a little bit about that in the last couple of minutes we got here?
Definitely, yes. Actually, one of our guests, Pekachase, Chief he's in Alberta right now starting, there's problems too. We have to understand that the First Nations people have also been infiltrated with, as they call the white man's disease. Money, right?
Same here. Yeah, same in the U.S.
Yeah, but he's been doing like this for 30 years. And so we have to break away from all ties of government that ties corruption into money. And we have a lot of groups here that they're very well-intentioned, and Idle No More. You're going to find some people that are marching. They're making awareness of, in New Brunswick, we had the shale gas movement there that went on a couple of years. We need to start really supporting the people that are supporting the Mother Earth, looking after who know two traditional ways how to do things, who are stewards of the land.
They know how to cure the planet.
Right. Absolutely. And they showed us how to build a society that's sustainable and promotes happiness over materialism.
Absolutely.
Do you know, Rick, that most of the Constitution was based on the Iroquois Constitution?
I have heard that. Unfortunately, they left out some of the best parts.
Yeah. Well, obviously.
Yeah, there were some parts they put in. But, I mean, basically that was, so the Constitution, I think the U.S. right now
When Washington and the Iroquois made their treaty, and they knew that the Americans were taking over, that was some of the things that, some of the wonderful and beautiful writing that we all respect and actually love were actually put in by the Iroquois Nation.
Yes, I was aware of that. It's a mixed legacy that we have in our U.S. relationship, the Founding Father, I should say, with the Native Americans. Guys, yeah. Listen, there was more that I wanted to get into, but we're out of time. So I just want to thank you, Al and Lisa, for being back on our show, and I'm looking forward to joining you again soon on Transition Mission on Awake Radio. That's it for this week.